The Committee on Taxes will come to order, the Committee of One for now. Senator Ortman, no, Committee of Two, I'm sorry, Senator Skoy. Senator Ortman is on her way in, she got stuck in traffic. But we can start, and the first bill on the agenda is 2405, Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, members.
Welcome,
distinguished members. Mr. Chair, this Senate file is regarding the Bielenberg Sports Complex, which is a sports complex in the city of Woodbury. And what we're looking for is an exemption from a referendum process. And we're going to be renovating, improving, and expanding the Bielenberg Sports Complex. This is an existing complex. It's an existing facility. And what we're really looking for is the ability to move forward with some repairs to the facility without going through the full process. And I have Mayor Giuliani Stevens, who will talk to us about the project.
Good morning, Mayor.
Good morning, committee members. Thank you. Mary Giuliani Stevens, the mayor of Woodbury. As the senator said, the Bielenberg Sports Center Dome is at the end of its useful life. So we're looking at replacing the bubble and doing replacing it with a permanent structure and then making some improvements in the lobby space, maybe with some options for other improvements. The original construction for the center and the dome facility and later improvements were voter approved through referendums. The facility is an enterprise fund, so it generates revenue. We did use revenue bonds for some energy and operational cost savings improvements as well. We have to do something with the roof. It's at the end of its useful life, and it would render it unusable if it's not improved. The community has been fully engaged in the process. We have a 14-member citizen task force that's looking at the project to make sure that we meet the needs of our community. The task force is going to finish their work in July. We expect bids to go out in the fall, construction in 2013, and with completion the first quarter of 2014. One option for financing the improvements would be to use the revenue bonds. The problem is the severe interest penalty. Woodbury has a AAA bond rating, and the fiscal consultants have estimated that there would be a $1.7 to $1.9 million in interest savings if we utilize general obligation bonds. So our preferred option is the financing package that is outlined in Senate File 2405. Woodbury would issue the general obligation bonds for the Bielenberg Sports Center rehabilitation, and the debt service would be structured in a way that we would continue the existing levies. So the result would be a fully funded project without any change in the tax levy for our residents. Our city council has unanimously adopted a resolution in support of this, and we are here to ask for the committee support. And I thank you, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions you might have.
Ms. Mayor, I do have one question. So did you say in how much the roof would cost?
The entire project budget right now is $15.5 million.
I'm sorry, $5
million? $15.5 million for the entire renovation project.
And these would be standard, what, 20 years?
I'm not sure the terms of the bonds for the savings. The original bonds, one expires in 2014 and one in 2019.
And one last question there is that, so these will be secured and paid off. The debt service will be paid. You'll use the fees from the facility to pay the debt service, is that correct?
Correct. It's an enterprise fund, so it takes care of itself in paying for the payments on the bonds, the operating expenses, and capital.
And one last question, Mayor, is how much will that be a year in estimation?
The cost?
Yes.
I don't have that answer. I'm
okay.
Sorry.
All right. Any other questions for the Mayor? Senator Skoy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mayor. You could do this if you were willing to have a referendum, I'm assuming. Are you worried that the referendum would fail, or what's the rationale for the exemption?
I think it's mostly the timing, and for me it was mostly the awareness that the savings that would be resulting. That was pretty significant to me when we looked at it. It had always been planned that those levies would be extended, and that's how the project was planned out. And that's how it'll be, you know, and that's how it would be bid out. But for me, when I saw this savings, I saw it as an opportunity to, you know, to come before you and ask for that authority to issue the GO bonds.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not understanding. Maybe Mr. Sowell would want to help me here, but you could do this without legislation if you had a referendum.
I assume we could. I don't believe that was under the original plan since those bonds were initially issued via referendum.
So you could achieve the savings without this bill if you went to a referendum. Are you worried that the referendum would fail?
No, I'm not worried about that.
Okay.
Senator
Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, I think with a rebuilding project versus an initial project, I think that citizens sometimes are less likely to support those types of projects. This is a vital asset to the community. It is a place, it is a dome facility that has a field underneath it. It's not an ice rink. And it is used for community resources, for community events, for sporting events, for a number of different things. It's really a centerpiece of the community. At the same time, I think that sometimes residents are less likely to support rebuilding a project such as this. It has reached the end of its useful life. And I think that also there is the cost of having the campaign, having notifying the public going through that process. So basically what we're trying to do is trying to save some money for the citizens on a project that is a vital resource to that community, and just looking for a tool that we can utilize to do this most cost effectively.
Thank you. Any other questions for Senator Lilly or the mayor? If not, this will be held over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Next on the agenda is 2467, Senator Saxhog.
Good morning, Senator, and welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Should I?
Please go ahead with your task project. Yes.
And members, today I'm presenting Senate File 2467. This bill amends a 2003 law that allowed Itasca County to issue revenue bonds to finance a nursing home, the Itasca County Nursing Home, which is owned by Itasca County. It's a 120 bed. Nursing home. The proposed change allows the county to issue general obligation bonds as well as the revenue bonds. And with me today is Jeff Walker, Itasca County Auditor, to give a brief testimony and help answer any questions.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Members, my name is Jeff Walker. I'm the Itasca County Auditor. The purpose of this amendment, Chair and members, is to give Itasca County the option to use GO bonds to refund a 2003 revenue bond issue for the Grand Village Nursing Home. The existing bonds, the outstanding bonds at this time are approximately $4 million. Current interest rate is about 6%. If we refund those bonds using GO bonds, we can realize approximately a 4% reduction in the interest rate, which will save about $1.8 million in cash flow, and discounted to net present value, that represents almost a $1.4 million savings to the nursing home. The current existing general law allows the use of GO bonds to fund this type of project, and so we're just asking to amend the special law to reflect what the general law says.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. And I asked Council Mr. Sylvia if he would just advise us as to the fact that we've done this before. And if you would, Mr. Sylvia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The general law allows general obligation bonds to be used for this purpose, but in 2003, the special law provided for only revenue bonds to be used in this case, but the general law does allow obligation bonds to be used, and under the general law, an election is not required if you're requiring, proving, remodeling, or replacing the existing nursing home without an increase in the total number of beds, which I understand is the project here. So we have done this before, and it would simply allow the general law to take control and for general obligation bonds to be used.
Mr. Walker, has this come before the public through public hearing process, and you feel like you have the support of the proposal, support of the community?
I believe it would, Madam Chair. I don't think this is a controversial issue, and it will save the nursing home about $100,000 a year in interest. So it's.
Any questions or comments for Senator Saxhog? Are there folks here that would like to testify one way or the other in support or in opposition to Senate File 2467? Seeing none, then I would like to hold Senate File 2467 over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam
Senator.
Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to skip to Senator Dames, Senate File 2158. I think folks are just gathering on the Hennepin County bill. So I saw Senator Dames here. Welcome back to the committee, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm here today to introduce Senate File 2158. Senate File 2158 is a bill for an act relating to education finance permitting a one-time fund transfer for Independent School District Number 88, New Ulm, Minnesota. New Ulm may permanently transfer up to $848,000 from its building construction fund to its reserved or capital projects account without corresponding levy adjustment in the debt service fund. That's the request of the bill, and I have the superintendent of the New Ulm School District, Harold Remy, with me today, and so I'll turn it over to Harold, and Harold can go ahead and give us some particulars.
Good morning, Madam
Welcome
Chair and committee members. Thank you for giving our bill consideration today. The situation that we had is we had a mold, significant mold problem back in the mid 2000s. We did a mold remediation project and installed a new heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system in all of our buildings. At the end of that project, we had about $848,000 left. It is currently sitting in a construction fund and not usable for us in any other way at this point. We do have a major project that we want to do in the future, and that will be to upgrade our infrastructure for our technology system. And as I see it, this transfer request would not result in any tax increase. And, in fact, it would prevent a tax increase because if we cannot transfer these funds, we'll probably have to go to an alternate facility bond to upgrade our technology system. Our technology system is 17 years old, and it's no longer possible for us to find replacement parts, and that is a project that we need to be moving forward with this summer. Any questions?
Well, Senator Chamberlain.
Someone had mentioned to me... So you said are the bonds paid off? Or that?
No, they're not fully paid off yet.
Okay. One other follow-up, Madam Chair.
Senator Chamberlain.
So, and you just said there you want to transfer them out. So the money's sitting there. You would like to transfer the money out to address other capital issues like,
that's correct.
Like IT accounts? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. McQuay, I'm wondering if you would comment on the revenue note that we've received here.
Madam Chair, while she's coming up.
Senator Skoy.
Superintendent, how old is the building?
How old is that?
I didn't catch you were talking about mold and age of the building that your building construction
we
fund
had,
is
we
for.
We had three buildings that we did some reconstruction with in additions in 1997. The reconstruction project is the part that ended up with a mold problem, and that was discovered in about 2003, I think it was. And then we were going through a process of remediation and putting in a new heating and ventilation system.
And Madam Chair, Superintendent, your buildings so are relatively new and in relatively good shape. You're not going to be...
Yes, they are. They're not new, but they're in very good shape.
Okay. Superintendent, could you state your name again for the record? We didn't
Harold
catch it.
Harold Remy.
Remy, R-E-M-Y?
R-E-M-M-E.
R-E-M-M-E. Thank you very much. Ms. McQuaid, can you comment on the revenue note?
Madam Chair and members, there's in your packets you should have received a fiscal note for this bill. There's no revenue estimate for this bill, but the and no general fund cost. There is, however, a levy cost associated with this. Under current law, the bond proceeds are to be transferred into the debt service account, and when there's excess buildup in the debt service account, that money is required to go back to the taxpayers in the form of reduced levies. And so what the department has said is that the transfer to the debt levy reduction would happen over 3 years, so it wouldn't be a debt levy reduction of $848,000 in 1 year. It would be over pay 2013, pay 2014, and pay 2015. And so even though there wouldn't be a levy increase, there is anticipated to be a levy decrease because of these excess funds. And so when you're holding the money and not transferring it back to the taxpayers, that results in a cost. And that's happening over 3 years.
Ms. McQuaid, how different is this than like a lease levy situation that we already have in our omnibus tax relief and jobs bill? How different is this?
Madam Chair and members, that's additional authority that the legislature is giving to the districts based on certain circumstances. This is a transfer of funds. The districts are required to establish certain funds for different purposes. And what the legislation says is that if you bond for projects, you need to start putting that levy amount into a certain fund to pay off those bonds. And so what this is asking to do is transfer the money out before the bonds are paid off into the operating capital account to be used for other uses. So even though the bond was for one, they went to the voters and asked to bond for a certain project, they're now asking to transfer it to another use.
Well, Superintendent Remy, how then do the bonds get paid off?
Bonds will be paid off in normal debt service levy.
Senator Chamberlain.
I always like to give deference to the school districts and allow them flexibility, but the bonds aren't paid off. He had a levy to solve a problem, then you put the debt service money into a fund to pay for that debt, and the debt isn't paid off, and now you want to transfer that money out of that account into another capital account and still levy the debt. I have to say that it seems a little bit premature, and I don't understand why you would do that. Conservatively thinking, you told the taxpayers it was going to be there to pay off X. Now you want to transfer it out before those are paid off, and you're still levying for that debt.
The dollars that we're talking about were left over in the construction process. Bids came in lower than expected and so forth. So those are quote-unquote excess dollars from that levy.
Superintendent Remy, isn't one of the options here to pay off the bonds earlier?
That would be an option. However, then we would, if we do not do this process, then we will go for another levy to do the alternate facility bonding for our technology.
Wouldn't that be more transparent to the voters and the residents of the school district to know that they paid off one project and now they're being asked to fund another one?
The transfer dollars wouldn't pay off the entire project. It's all over a longer time period.
But it could pay down those bonds early.
It could. And I think what she's talking about over here in terms of from the State Department, that would be metered out over a three-year period.
Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, and I'm wondering if this at all affects the formula on the education funding at all. Does it? Is
not
there any interlace? Because I know some
no,
of the
not to my
superintendent.
Knowledge.
We have a record and we're recording, so we want to make sure one person is speaking at a time that we identify. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That would be my question, is if there is any interaction at all on the school funding formula. I'd like to have some clarification on that.
To my knowledge, it would not influence the funding formula at all.
Well, Senator Dames, I'm going to say I'm reluctant. I wouldn't say no until I read a little bit more about it, and we do have this note. Is there something that I'm missing here? Because it sounds to me like we're confusing the voters by taking funds that were voted for a particular project and using them for something else. That's what it sounds like to me. What am I missing? Am I missing something, Superintendent or Senator Dames?
Well, you know, I don't understand the school financing 100%, so I'm not so sure that I can answer your question, but I do think if we're looking at having the excess funds in this account, transferring them over to the capital account, and we are taking the reduction of the $280-some thousand a year against the levy, it does save the cost of another referendum, and it does save the cost of going out in front of the voters again, which is another cost. But various ways to look at it, I think that this would be probably one of the more efficient ways to do it.
I think that's a good argument, Senator Dames. I mean, I think that if there are efficiencies in the project and you've saved the taxpayers money, how best do you deal with that? And do you put it to another good use, or do you buy down the bonds early? I think that's what I'm struggling with. Any other questions, Senator Chamberlain?
Yeah, I would, Madam Chair, Senator Dames, I would agree with that assessment. And I guess again, deference to this school districts to be able to have flexibility in what they do with their money, but somehow ensuring the voters so they know where the money's going and what's happening to it and where it's being reallocated, you know, the transparency piece. But I would agree with Senator Ortman there. Thanks.
Other questions or comments? Are there folks here that would like to testify one way or the other on Senate File 2158? Seeing none, the chair will lay over for possible inclusion in Senate File 2158. Thank you.
Thank
both.
You, Madam Chair and members.
I think the Hennepin County folks are out of the room, so we will move on to Senate File 2083, the liquor reporting requirements. Senator Michelle, are you ready to go? And for the record, we do have a quorum this morning. Senator Michelle.
Madam Chair, I think I might be follow the law. I'm texting and legislating at the same time.
And Senator Michelle, I have to say I'm not sure why modifying liquor reporting requirements comes before the tax committee. So why don't you begin with that, or at least address your comments to that, if you would.
Yeah. Madam Chair and members, thank you. So Senate File 2083, I think it's before you because of its because of the Department of Revenue, the issues that overlap with the department. That's the short answer. So this bill, members, would eliminate the requirement for wholesalers, and that's who I'm sitting with this morning, would eliminate the requirement for wholesalers to provide the Department of Revenue the tax exemption certificate number for retailers. We put this requirement into law a few years ago at the request of the department to assist in audits, but the reality is that wholesalers, they don't have access to these tax exemption numbers. They're given by revenue to the retailer, not the wholesaler. So revenue has the certificate numbers. In addition, a retailer can only receive a liquor license from public safety if they have a valid tax exemption certificate. Wholesalers sell only to retailers with valid liquor licenses. That's what you'll hear this morning. If a wholesaler fails to comply, liability for the tax falls on the wholesaler. It's a pretty stiff penalty. So, Madam Chair, I have Mr. Bungie with me this morning, and also Mr. Johnson from the industry.
Great.
Sorry, it's Mr. Richards from Johnson Brothers. So, if you can have them be part of the record on this, and then if there are questions, that would be great.
Thank you. Mr. Bungie, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name for the record is Daryl Bungie. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Wholesale Wine and Spirits Council. We're a trade association representing the wholesale liquor industry in Minnesota. We have some particular problems with this requirement in that we're required to give information that we don't necessarily have direct access to, nor are we necessarily provided with correct information. And with me today is Fred Richards from Johnson Brothers, one of the members of our association. He can talk to you in particular how this this works or how it doesn't work. So with that, Madam Chair, stand for any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Richards, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Fred Richards. I am the credit director for Johnson Brothers Liquor Company. We're a wholesale distributor of alcohol. This bill is the reason why that we're asking to have the not to have to supply the forms. Just like Mr. Michelle said, we don't get the numbers from these tax ID numbers from the Department of Revenue. We have to provide them to the Department of Revenue, but we don't get them. We get those from the retailer. And so the Department of Revenue issues the number, provides them to the retailer, and they don't provide them to us. We ultimately are held responsible for collecting these tax numbers and then providing them to the Department of Revenue, and we're held accountable and potentially face fines if we don't supply the correct number. However, we don't have any way of gathering them. So it provides we have a significant expense that we go through every year to try and capture these numbers from the retailers. Retailers are suspicious of why we're asking for them, and we have a lot of difficulty even getting them in order to provide this report to the state.
Sounds like a catch-22 to me. But Ms. Von Mosch is here to testify from the Department of Revenue, and she can maybe shed some light on this. Ms. Von Mosch?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. And I do have someone from the department to help me out with some questions on this, too, if I need to call a friend. So the department does, when there is a retailer, my name is Susan Von Mosch. I'm with the Department of Revenue for the record. When there is a retailer, all retailers are required to have exemption certificates, not just the liquor distributors. And then in the case of a liquor distributor, there is a requirement that the liquor distributors, when they make sales, that they do get a copy of that exemption certificate. It's an exemption for resale, so they don't pay the tax to the wholesaler, but they collect the tax at the retail level. And we do not require that the exemption certificates be filed with the annual report, but that the wholesaler is supposed to keep those exemption certificates on file for purposes of audit. So if they are ever audited, they would have the exemption certificate. Our main concern with this bill is the section of the bill that is Section 2, which provides that the tax ID number does not have to be reported on the annual report coming from the wholesaler. This was a provision that was enacted in 2007, and it was put in place to help improve compliance with tax laws. And we feel like if that is removed, that the report would not contain the purchaser's tax identification number, and it would really affect our ability to effectively conduct compliance activities. What happens is that people have a tax ID number, but they might operate multiple businesses. They might have a tax ID number under one name, but then their business might be named something else. They may have a tax ID number, but that tax ID number is listed at an address where the is not necessarily the address of the business. So there are various reasons why the tax ID number is the common identifier that is used to track the retail activity. And I don't know if I've done a very good job of explaining that, but I do have Dave Delaney from the department here to answer further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Delaney. Welcome, and thank you for being here. I do have a question. The Department of Revenue, it sounds like its interest in this, is to audit the sales tax that should be collected on the retail transactions. Is that right? And so what you're
essentially, I would say that is correct. Right.
Although
Mr. Delaney,
distributors are subject to audit also, and the general provision in the sales tax statute is that you must maintain exemption certificates. Gross receipts are subject to the sales tax, and then to qualify for an exemption, you need to maintain an exemption certificate. That's true for any business and any industry.
Well, but I think that's what Senator Michelle is trying to get at here, which is you're creating requirements on the part of the distributors to help you audit the transactions of the retailers. Is that what's happening here? And I can see why you would want these taxpayers to be cooperative and help you, but I'm not sure that I think what you're asking is for them to audit the retail transactions on your behalf. And we've had testimony in this committee before about how onerous and burdensome the auditing on sales taxes can be. And Senator Skoy, I know that's one of the things that you're interested in, too. And so I'm wondering, I think the department should be able to justify, explain why it is that you think that the distributors should be assisting you in auditing the retail transactions.
Madam Chair, Senators, we feel the report is a report where the information is gathered and the distributors have that information. We don't require them to give us that exemption certificate through this report. We only require the Minnesota identification number. And through that Minnesota identification number, as Susan indicated, that's the common thread to identify where the sales are made, and it helps us utilize our resources in the compliance area where once we get this information, I'll just give an example, if a particular retailer purchases $400,000 in liquor, we can check our systems, and if they only report $100,000, then that indicates there's probably a problem there. So we can utilize our resources to go to that retailer and then conduct an audit. The department will conduct an audit of that retailer. And also, if someone else purchases $400,000 and they report to us, let's say $600,000, if that's within those parameters where the pricing and all the other variables are taken into account, then we don't have to bother those retailers with an audit because we have this information that gives us a better selection process.
Well, Mr. Delaney, one of the first things you said is that they have the information, and I think you've just heard them testify that they don't have that information and they're having a hard time getting that information from the retailers. And it would be nice for you if they did provide all that information. It certainly makes analysis a lot easier for you. I understand that, but I'm just not sure this is the most direct method for auditing the sales tax compliance on the part of the retailers.
Chair and Senator, it is a requirement that they have these certificates. So it's nothing that we're adding to. We're not increasing their burden. It's something they should already have.
Well, that's the part that seems to beg the question. I think Senator Michelle's effort here is to say they shouldn't have to. What do you say to that?
Because every retailer in the state of Minnesota, when someone makes a sale, presumption that sale is subject to the sales tax in the statute. So in order for that sale to be exempt, the person making the sale must have an exemption certificate on file.
Well, isn't the exemption to the wholesaler, but the retailer still has the obligation of collecting and remitting the sales tax?
Correct. That's a separate obligation. The wholesaler has an obligation to substantiate that their sale is exempt.
Is that because they're substantiating the fact that it's a wholesale transaction and not a retail transaction? Is that what you're saying their responsibility is?
Yes. Anyone making a sale has the responsibility. The burden of proof is always on the seller, according to the statutes. And to relieve that burden of proof, one of the requirements is to maintain an exemption certificate. This is true for any sale.
To the testifiers, if I could ask, if you're maintaining an exemption certificate, is it the requirements for how you maintain that the issue here? It's getting and recording the tax ID numbers? Is that it?
Madam Chair, we had last year, I'll give you an example, is that we had approximately 5,500 customers that we had to submit on this report. About 63 customers did not give us a correct number or gave us an invalid number or didn't provide a number on those forms. We submitted our report and then was kicked back to us because it fell out of tolerance from the Department of Revenue, saying that we had not complied with this report. However, we rely on what the customer tells us is the correct number. And to satisfy Form ST3, any one of four numbers could be given in order to satisfy the requirements of the ST3. One is the Minnesota tax ID number that the customer would put on there, or they could also offer a federal ID number or a number that's issued by another state, or their driver's license number. So the retailer could ultimately provide any one of those four numbers to us. We don't necessarily know that it's that it satisfies the report that we have to submit to the Department of Revenue, though.
I have one more question, and then I'll let Senator Chamberlain ask the question. But if to the Department of Revenue, if I were a retailer that was trying to skirt the responsibility to pay the sales tax or collect it, why wouldn't I just give these gentlemen the wrong number?
Why would you give them the wrong number?
Why wouldn't I? If I didn't want to pay the sales tax, I wouldn't want you to be able to know about the transaction, and I either would give them no number or I'd give them the wrong number just to try and avoid the audit on the part of the department.
Madam Chair, that is possible, but we don't require the distributors. We allow them to accept the number in good faith, and so they're not required to verify if that number is correct. And we will accept any of those numbers that Mr. Richards indicated. And if the numbers are in error, we don't hold them responsible. They accepted that in good faith, and we accept that.
Senator Chamberlain.
Well, now I'm really confused. So they're seeking relief, some relief from the department, and for the requirement to have these exemption numbers, but you're saying that even if the numbers they have on the report are wrong, they're taken in good faith, then there shouldn't be a problem. But apparently there is a problem. Am I correct? And so that gets to the piece. So if they submit this report, they got five numbers that were out of tolerance. They weren't validated. What happens to the wholesaler? What's that process? I mean, if you accept it in good faith, it would seem like it would go away. But what's the process to the testifiers?
Mr. Richards, is it?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The process is that we will receive the example that I had. It was that in the last tax year, we received a letter from the Department of Revenue later saying that we had this 5,500 customers that we had supplied to them. There were 63 that were some sort of invalid number, and that was outside their tolerance, so that we had to go back and try and regather some of that information to gather the actual Minnesota tax ID number from those customers. We had to contact them by phone, mail, Had our salespeople contact them, try and regather some of this information. We meet a lot of resistance. I've already given you this information. I don't trust you. I don't know why you need this information. So it's a lot of difficulty. And we go to a great expense trying to gather this.
Madam Chair.
Senator Chamberlain.
Then are you subject to, does a DOR, are you subject to penalty and fine then if you can't validate those numbers?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, sir. We are subject to potential fine and potentially have to pay the sales tax on the sales to that customer.
One final question, Madam Chair.
Senator Chamberlain.
So if you just said we take those numbers in good faith, and I've read the statute and that's what it says, but then you send a letter to the wholesaler saying double check, and that's kind of a federal process. You get a second attempt to request this information, and they'd go to that work to do it. Then they're subject to penalty. How can you accept? How can you say you accept it in good faith and then send a letter and say you're subject to penalty or fines if you don't validate this? Shouldn't they be immune at some point from a good faith effort to try to get the correct numbers?
Mr. Delaney.
Senator, that's a good question, and glad I have an opportunity to explain it. The number of transactions that Mr. Richards referred to, I believe there were more than 63, because if it was only 63, we would not have bothered them with additional information. But in any instance, if they accept that in good faith, we have a responsibility then, if there are some incorrect numbers, that's our responsibility to research that. We have not assessed the penalty on the 2010 report, which is due March 31st, 2011. We have not assessed the penalty. Our intention is not to assess the penalty. The information is very valuable to us. I've granted extensions to Mr. Richards past the due dates, and worked with Mr. Richards, and he's been very helpful, very cooperative, and we appreciate that. And that our intention is not to assess this penalty, and generally we do not. It's only the penalty was assessed.
Mr. Delaney, I don't think that we need to know the specifics of any relationship or potential penalty against anyone. I think we'd like to look at this more as a public policy question and not a dispute between the Department of Revenue and any one or specific taxpayer. If you would keep your comments to that, I would appreciate it.
Madam Chair,
Senator Chamberlain.
So I understand the desire of the Department of Revenue, but it seems like we have a process that says you're not really going to be, you have to accept this in good faith, and that's fine. But if you reach this tolerance, then we're going to send a letter to you. And then if you don't do X, then we're going to penalize you. But I don't really intend on levying that penalty, assessing that penalty. Isn't there a little bit too much discretion there? I understand what you're trying to get at here, but I think there's a little bit too much discretion there, and there's no firm in the federal 1099 reporting. You go through this horrendous process of getting numbers and second attempts and mailings and all that sort of stuff, and we don't want to go down that road necessarily. But at what point does this cut off and say, okay, the wholesalers did their due diligence, they followed up, they did what they're supposed to do by the statute, by law, but now they're being subject to the vagaries of departmental bureaucracy, and I'm sorry, I don't mean of the system. So at what point is that shut off and the wholesalers are held harmless because they've done what they were supposed to do by statute?
Madam Chair, Senator Chamberlain, there aren't vagaries of the department. We have procedures we follow. We try to work cooperatively with all taxpayers. We strive for voluntary compliance on all types of taxes, whether they be individual, whether they be business, corporate. We have procedures that we follow, and that is what I think we've explained the procedures we follow, and we try to work cooperatively with people, and sometimes not everyone's happy.
It would just, Madam Chair, it just seemed at some point that you'd have to have a cutoff and they'd be relieved. But that's all. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Madam Chair, you're right. I have struggled with this sales tax compliance issue. I've not been supportive of our budgeting mechanisms that we've used to these compliance initiatives. I think it's driving Minnesota businesses crazy. But I think my question is for the department. So I'm in the ag business, and because I'm a farmer, a number of things that I buy are sales tax exempt. And I go to company XYZ in Minneapolis and buy something for my farm. They require me to fill out a sales tax form with my tax exempt number and my federal ID and all of that stuff. Otherwise, they don't sell it to me sales tax exempt. I have to pay the sales tax. So I fill these forms out. So then does that XYZ company put them on file so when you come to do your sales tax audits, you can take a look at my what I've been doing? Or what is this the process that we're concerned about today with the liquor folks?
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, yes, that is my understanding, and
that's
you
correct.
Can correct me, is that then that company that you are doing business with can document why they have not collected the sales tax from you because you have declared yourself to be exempt for that purchase.
And then, Madam Senator Chair, to the testifiers, you know, I sympathize with you on this, but I have to ask this question. Why, to your retailers, don't you do what the companies that I buy from do to me, which is they won't give me the sales exemption unless I fill out the forms and put the right numbers in there?
Mr. Richards or Mr. Bungie?
There's a small percentage of customers that do want us to charge them sales tax. Typically, we try and gather those forms right up front when we first sign a new customer up for purchases. We typically will set them up actually from a website from the department. I'll call gambling and set the customer up in our system. Salesperson contacts the customer. You'd like to purchase from us. We have them fill out forms. But it is very difficult to capture these forms. We don't always get them back from the customer immediately, so we have to follow up.
Well, and Mr. Bungie wanted to address that point as well, Mr. Bungie?
Well, before I leave that, please.
Senator Skoy.
But Mr. Carlson or Johnson or
Richards.
The businesses that I buy from, they charge me sales tax then. And I don't want to pay sales tax, so I make sure I get the right forms to them. I'm not tracking where the difficulty comes in.
Mr. Bungie.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, I think you've hit on the root of the problem. You're dealing with a retailer. We're wholesalers. We don't collect sales tax. And I think in the case of your situation, that's exactly what your retail liquor store would ask you for. But in our case, we're the wholesaler. We don't collect sales tax. We sell only to retailers who are valid retailers with valid liquor license. And the only way they can get a valid liquor license is to have a retail sales tax exemption certificate. And so we're in essence put in the shoes of the retailer to do what the department would like to see done.
And so, Mr. Bungie, you're like Fairfield, whatever company that's supplying X, Y, and Z that's selling to me. Oh, so you're one step up the chain.
Yeah. Exactly.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
And then, though, if you sell it, you're not selling it, you know, door to door, but you're selling it to big chains and or to the small retailer, right, Mr. Bungie? When you,
Madam Chair, that's correct.
When you get this form or you ask for the tax ID numbers, are you also getting the names and addresses so that if the department wanted to audit, they could by having your customer's name as well? Mr. Richards.
Yes, ma'am.
So instead of the wholesalers trying to check and verify the ID numbers, the Department of Revenue could do that with the information that you're providing because you're already giving them the names of your customers and their addresses and whatever tax ID number or they gave you, correct?
Yes.
Senator Dibble, anything further?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think Senator Skoy pretty much covered the ground I was going to cover. I was going to point out the circumstance of having been the executive director of a
nonprofit organization in similar situation. You know, I had to fill out my tax-exempt forms when I made purchases. I'm actually not seeing the problem here. I'm just not seeing it. If something in terms of a process is sticking in someone's craw, I think, you know, we can, the agency and the stakeholders can work out an accommodation for a better process. But to not collect this information at all, I think, is not wise. I become pretty concerned about the tax compliance issues that Ms. Von Mosch has raised. I think that's a real concern. We don't have record keeping on both sides. You know, we'll see some compliance problems.
Senator Skoy, anything further?
I think I shouldn't ask this, Madam Chair, to the department, because I assume this was part of a 2007 compliance issue that raised money for the state. Is there going to be a fiscal cost to this initiative?
Von Mosch.
Senator Skoy, there is not a, oh, it's right in front of me. Senator Skoy, there is not a cost identified with this initiative.
Thank you.
Senator Michelle, I'm not sure if we took a vote on this, how we end up today, but I would ask you to continue to work with the members and provide information to the members, and I would like to lay it over for possible inclusion. Without objection, Senate File 2083 will be held over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Senator Hall. Members, we do have some out of the guests from out of the area, and we will try and get to the Vesta, Grand Rapids, and Big Fork proposals next after the Hennepin County provision. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Appreciate being able to present this bill at the committee this morning. We have before you Senate File 1325, the Hennepin County Environmental Response Fund. This bill provides funding to assess and clean up contaminated sites that are unlikely to be funded by other programs. The bill extends the sunset from 2013 to 2018. I know we have some testifiers today, but we'll start out, if we could, Madam Chair, with the testifier from Hennepin County. And I do have some handouts if page passes.
Sure. Commissioner Callison, welcome.
Good morning, Senator Ortman. My name is Jan Callison. I'm a member of the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning. As Senator Hall said, this bill relates to the IRF, or the Environmental Response Fund. This program provides grants for environmental assessment and cleanup of sites that are unlikely to be funded by other grant programs. It was established in 1997 in Hennepin County and is funded by a mortgage registry and deed tax in Hennepin of 1/100 of 1%, or $30, on a transaction of $150,000. As a result of IRF, contaminated properties are put back into productive use. Every 5 years, we must ask again for legislative reauthorization, as we are doing today. This program will end on January 1st, 2013, without your action. I want to make 3 points this morning as I ask for your support. The first is that this is an established program with proven results. We're not asking you to accept our word for it. We're not promising you results that we can't prove. We can tell you exactly what this program has done. Since 2001, 264 grants have been awarded, totaling $37 million. That $37 million has leveraged another $1.7 billion in privately funded development costs and $53 million in public investments from DEED, the Met Council, and from federal sources. As a result of this program, the $37 million investment has produced a $433 million increase in property values. This is a 12-to-1 return on investment, and $48 million more in property taxes. My second point is that everyone wins when these properties are put back into productive use. Examples of successes exist throughout Hennepin County. Here are two.
The Edgewood Business Center in St. Louis Park had been vacant for more than 5 years and was a subject of more than 45 police calls, including calls relating to a meth lab operating on site. The former White House restaurant site in Golden Valley was a tax forfeit state Superfund site and became assisted living for seniors. Neighborhoods win when problem buildings and blighting influences are removed. Individuals win when jobs, houses, and green space are created, and when environmental hazards are removed. And government wins at all levels by an improved tax base, as well as by employed, housed, and healthy residents. And finally, we are not asking for anything new today, just the extension of a proven program. Again, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I don't know when the right time is, but I have an amendment to add Ramsey County, which has the same thing, and a Ramsey County commissioner as well to testify on that.
Senator Hall.
On the amendment, I'm pretty neutral on that. If the members want the amendment, we can put that on.
Madam Chair, I'll offer the amendment if Senate Council has it.
Senator Marty offers the A1 amendment. We're going to hand that out. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Janice Rettman is here, I see, too, if you want to have some brief comments. It's a very similar thing, and we're handing out how Ramsey County has used it. The two counties both had it, and been used in similar ways. I don't know if you wish testimony.
I'm hoping, Mr. Sylvia, would you just address, we're looking at the language. It doesn't reference Ramsey County specifically, but this would then apply to the Ramsey County provisions in our statute. Is that the specific Ramsey County section?
That's correct, Madam Chair. The bill, as it is right now, references 383B, which is a statute for Hennepin County. What this amendment does is add statute 383A, which references Ramsey County, and what this bill or this amendment does is also extend the authority to impose the tax through 2018, which is the same that the underlying bill 1325 accomplishes.
Senator Marty, can I ask you to hold on your amendment for a moment? I know that Paul Eager is here from the Association of Realtors that would like to testify, and I think it makes sense to take his testimony before we start voting on Sure. amendments to the bill. Mr. Paul Eager? I'm sorry, I may not have pronounced your name correctly.
Madam Chair,
Senator
we also
Hall.
Have another testifier in support of the bill, so I'll just make note of that.
All right, thank you, Senator. Mr. Eager, did I pronounce that correctly?
Madam Chair, Paul Eager.
Eager, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. Again, my name is Paul Egger with the Minnesota Association of Realtors, and we're here to testify in opposition to the extension of the sunset dates for these two taxes. And let me just start, Madam Chair. I'm going to focus my comments on the tax policy that I'd like you to consider, but in response to the county's presentation, you're going to hear from Ramsey County, I assume, next, and the counties have a great story to tell. There are a lot of worthwhile projects that have been completed, and the purpose of me getting up today and testifying against this is not to call into question the work that they're doing at the county level. It's to ask you to consider the appropriateness of this funding mechanism, which is the tax policy before this committee within this bill and in the amendment that you're going to be considering. And just to put it very simply, our position is that programs and activities like the ones that have been described truly do benefit all the residents and all the businesses in these counties, and therefore the taxpayers, all the residents of those counties, should be asked to pay the part, pay their share of the costs and support the fund, rather than the way it is now, which is these two counties alone have this additional tax that the state has authorized, and so a small subset of the populations in these two counties are asked to foot the bill for paying for the different activities that are carried out through the fund. And so I'm here today just to raise that tax policy, to share our concerns with the extension of the sunset, which would be the third extension since it was implemented in the late 90s. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I do have a question for Commissioner Callison. We met about this before. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know how much the tax had raised or raises annually and how much is in a fund if it's not been spent.
Thank you, Senator Ortman. In 2011, the IRF revenues were $1.8 million, according to the information that I have, 1.8. And, of course, it varies from year to year depending upon how many transactions. I think the fund has a couple of million dollars in it currently. I may need to verify that number, and if it's important to be accurate, I can ask staff and get back to you.
Commissioner, I would like to know that number, and I'll ask the Commissioner of Ramsey County as well for the same information. Senator Rust.
Thank you. Mr. Egger, could you go back over the history of the realtors' testimony on this proposal?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, my involvement in this issue dates to my joining the realtors, which is relatively recently. I've been with the realtors since December of 2010, so I wasn't part of the discussions that occurred in the 90s and into the 2000s. But I can, so I'm testifying to our position as it stands today, and has been our position since I joined the realtors.
Senator Rest.
Well, Madam Chair, I hope there would be someone from your organization that could give us that history, because my recollection is that, particularly with regard to Hennepin County, there was objection in the past to the extension of Ramsey County, but with regard to Hennepin County, the realtors were either supportive or and testified so publicly, or they were neutral. And I wonder what's changed with regard to the Hennepin County portion. I do believe that there was a change of heart from the realtors with regard to Ramsey County, but what's changed? And it can't simply be, I would suggest, that it's because they hired you.
Senator Rest, I was here when they extended this the last time, and I remember that the realtors were either neutral or supportive. I don't remember them being opposed. But I do think one of the major changes has been the recession, and the numbers of transactions have gone down. The costs of transactions, we want to minimize those. I mean, I think those are logical differences in where we may have been in the past, because I had the same question. What's changed? And I, honestly, I think that's a good reason, Senator Rust.
Well, Senator Ortman, I don't dispute your analysis of it, but I want to hear a definitive answer from the realtors that they not only think it's a good program, but that they're willing to be that they're no longer willing to be neutral on extending it.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Rest, as I stated, the position of the realtors has not changed in the almost two years that I've been with the association. So this isn't, as you mentioned, a change that occurred because I joined the association. It predates me joining the group. All I can testify to, Madam Chair and Senator Rest, is that our position today is that we think 15 years has been is long enough. The extension of the sunset is before you for the third time, and we're simply asking the legislature to send the message that however important these programs and activities are, that they are beneficial to all the residents of these counties, and therefore an appropriate way to fund them would be to ask all the people who benefit to contribute to the cost of providing those services. So, Madam Chair, Senator Rest, I wish I could share with you what the discussions were in 1997 and in 2002 and in 2008, but I simply wasn't a party to those discussions. Well,
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair and Mr. Egger, well, I was here, and my memory is pretty good about this issue. Senator Hall, I support your bill and carried it myself in the past, and what these dollars leverage is absolutely incredible in terms of the benefits to all of the taxpayers in Hennepin County, and I certainly hope I have to be Senator Marty. I have to be an advocate for my county over your county. Not sure I'll support your amendment, quite frankly, because I feel so strongly about what's happened in Hennepin County, and would would not want this this program jeopardized by enlarging it. And maybe that's a parochial attitude, but there it is. And I do hope the realtors will, I respect them tremendously, work with you on a number of issues. I hope the realtors will reconsider their position and that we can move forward on this proposal.
Thank you. Senator Bibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Egger, I think I heard you say that the realtors support the program and the goals of the Environmental Response Fund. Is that true?
Mr. Egger?
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, you know, all the conversations that we've had with the counties this session and had the pleasure to hear this presentation a couple times in the other body, you know, we certainly don't take issue with the way the dollars are being spent, the uses of the fund, the story that they're able to tell in terms of the accomplishments of their programs. But I would just go back, and Senator Ress mentioned it as well, and as did the testifier, that the residents of Hennepin County truly do benefit from it. And we haven't seen any evidence that would cause us to question that. And therefore, for us, it raises the question, if everybody benefits, shouldn't everybody also contribute? And the way it's funded now, it's just asking a smaller number of people to contribute to paying the costs of these programs.
Okay, Senator Michelle. Senator Dibble.
Follow-up. Thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Egger, I don't want to get ahead of myself, and I don't want to be in a problem-solving mode necessarily. I don't know what's going to happen with Senator Hall's bill, which I support, and thank you, Senator Hall, for bringing it forward. But would the realtors, should you prevail in this institution with your point of view, which I suspect you have quite a bit of juice, and you may well do that, would you be in a posture to help solve the problem of the loss of the Environmental Response Fund and help support? Obviously, it would have to go to the Hennepin County property tax levy. In that case, would the realtors be in a position and a posture to support solving that problem and supporting the goals of the Environmental Response Fund in that case?
The question was directed to Mr. Egger. We're going to hear from him, then briefly from Commissioner Callison, then briefly from Senator Michelle, and then we're going to hear from the Ramsey County Commissioner, who's been waiting patiently in the back. So in that order, Mr. Egger.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, in you know, the dialogue that's occurred this session with both Hennepin and Ramsey County, as we shared our concerns with the funding source, we've raised a number of different options, and I assume the county can address their concerns with these other alternatives. But one is certainly that it can compete with other priorities within the county budget. The fund balance could be used to create a revolving fund moving forward. You heard about the return on investment in terms of the amount of property taxes collected as a result of properties being returned to the tax rolls. That's also, you know, we've raised as an opportunity to create some sort of a revolving loan fund. And lastly, Senator Dibble, you mentioned it could be placed on the property tax. As a state association, we certainly don't weigh in on different county levies. We believe that local units of government should have the ability to set their priorities and share their priorities with their taxpayers, and we wouldn't oppose something like that being put to the taxpayers.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble, very briefly, we do have a schedule.
I would just respond by saying, Trigger, you're here to advocate for the elimination of the source of funding that's been identified. It means this program goes away, and you don't then get to just say hands off. You know, we support this. This is a wonderful thing. Now it's your problem. We've killed it. Now it's your problem to solve. I think the realtors will then have to be in a position to take leadership if they believe that this is good for your client base and our community as a whole.
Madam Senator Chair. Dibble, I think Senator Michelle would like to comment.
Senator Dibble, I do think we need to get into a problem-solving mode on this one, and I want to be a part of that. But I think what is before us, it's a sunset. And so the tax policy issue then is, okay, let's review the program. That's what the legislature that put this into place and then extended it, I guess, a couple times. The point of a sunset is to review it. And so I think there's a little more testimony to take this morning. I have a bias. I like what Commissioner Callison has been doing. I like what Hennepin County has been doing. I'm starting to learn a little more about Ramsey County, but I think we need to get that first and then decide what tax policy going forward do we want to have. But I think it's quite fair to say there. So Mr. Eggers actually just pushing for current law. Current law is a sunset. So I guess I commit to Senator Hall and Senator Marty on the Ramsey County issue and Senator Rest and others who've spoken up that let's try to figure this out, but we really can't quite do that until we've heard from everyone. So right there, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Commissioner Callison, very briefly, and then Commissioner from Ramsey County, if you'd join us at the table, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The answer to your earlier question is $2.5 million is the fund balance. And then just 3 points, again, in response to this conversation. First, the tax base or the base, the number of people, is wider than you might think. If you think of over the course of your lifetime how many times you sell property, you might refinance your property, businesses that buy and sell. So this is not as narrow a base as you might think. For example, in 2003, there were 194,000 transactions. So more people being touched than you might think. In terms of why this is on property sales and exchanges, this is a cleanup of property. So while the benefits are widely spread, it also relates to cleanup of property. So it made sense to tailor it to that transaction or that action itself. And thirdly, looking today in terms of whether we could replace this funding stream, if you look at the county's budget, if you look at the demands for money, if you look at the resources, this is a dedicated fund, and we know how it's used, and it's used to benefit the citizens, the neighborhoods, and state, local government, and it's a good source of funds, and so I hope you'll be supportive of it.
Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, it's an honor, Senators. My name is Janice Rettman. I'm Ramsey County Commissioner and proud of it. Recognizing your time constraints, I'm going to be very short and to the point. Ramsey County IRF came into existence legislatively at the same time as Hennepin County. However, we did not implement it until 2003 when we were ready to go. The Environmental Response Fund for Ramsey County has collected $6.4 million over an 8.5-year period, which is leveraged cleanup dollars of $42.4 million, which has led to $791 million of new development, which now host 4,000 new full-time jobs and over 1,000 new housing units. 220 acres of the 2,500 acres that we have identified in Ramsey County as brownfields have been cleaned up with an increased market value of $364 million. The Ramsey County IRF is last in only after all development dollars and cleanup dollars have been secured and are only used for environmental cleanup. Without IRF, Ramsey County cannot compete with greenfields. With it, Ramsey County has helped return brownfields to productivity and have all benefited from the return of the investment of greenbacks. We thank you for your time, and we hope for your support.
Thank you, Commissioner. I can see you're very proud of that program.
Thank you.
Senator Marty would like to offer the A1 amendment. Senator Marty.
Yeah, Madam Chair, these programs were authorized at the same time. They've been together all along, and I strongly support the Hennepin County one and the Ramsey County one. The brochure that Ramsey County put out, like the Hennepin County ones, you can see what's been done. It's $6 million over 10 years, practically, in Ramsey County, and it's made a huge difference. And I think it is a dedicated fund, and it's been used as it's been intended. I'd urge support for this.
Senator Hall, on the amendment to add Ramsey County. Do you have a position, Senator Hall?
I'm not taking a position on that, no.
Thank you. So then, other questions or comments? We do want to move briefly here. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The A1 is adopted. And are there other amendments to Senator Hall's 1325?
Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
Would it be your intent to, as we have with other pieces of legislation, to lay this bill over, given the fact that we, given the testimony, now given the amendment, to figure out where this and how this can go moving forward?
That would be my plan, Senator Michelle, although I have to say I think I'd really like the guidance from Hennepin County and Ramsey County legislators about how to proceed. And I would encourage you all to visit with each other. This is a proposal. Senator Skoy, you and I are kind of out of the mix here, but and Senator Rosen, Senator Howe, Bach. I mean, we have a position, of course, but I think this affects your residents directly, and I'd like your guidance going forward about whether this should be included in the omnibus bill or not. But with that, I would like to,
Madam Chair,
Senator Rest.
Thank you very much. As chair of the Hennepin County delegation for the Senate, I appreciate the opportunity to work with Senator Michelle and Marty and Dibble to present a united front that we hope that the tax committee members who are not from Hennepin or Ramsey might be willing to endorse in a larger bill. I appreciate that opportunity. Thank you very much.
Senator Rust, unity and bipartisanship are in in high demand around here, so anything you can do to advise us would be very, very good. Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, I follow my chair in all things.
I'm counting on that, Senator Dibble.
And did he mean you or me? You know,
I'm hoping he means me. So the chair, Senator Hull.
One more testifier. Do you have time for that?
I think you're doing pretty well here without that testimony, and I think the well-advised would be to leave it where it is, and without objection, the chair would like to lay over Senate File 1325 as amended for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you all. In the interest of brevity, knowing what I do about the proposals, I'm going to ask that Senator Dames and Saxhog join us at the table together, and one representative from Vesta, one from Grand Rapids, and one from Big Fork. I know you all came quite a ways for this, but I think that we should deal with these bills together. Members, what these bills do is retroactively grant permission to these cities that had a hard time filing their audit reports. There can be a penalty for their LGA if they don't file their audit documents within a certain time period, and so they are looking for relief from a penalty, is my understanding. Senator Saxhog, do you want to introduce the issue to the members?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. We are presenting these local government aid payments, which through one reason or another, we're not. The applications weren't filed in time, as you say, we're asking for relief. But, Madam Chair, what I'd really like to do here, it'll only take a few minutes, is introduce Sean Gillen, Administrator for the City of Grand Rapids, to give some brief testimony about a possible solution in the future for this type of situation.
Madam Chair, Senators, thank you. It's an honor to be here. The situation in Bovee, Minnesota, is a unique and an unfortunate one. When the elected officials in Bovee found out they had suspicions of some issues in their city clerk's office, they took immediate action. They came to us, they took action with the individual, and they contracted with the City of Grand Rapids to do their financial accounting for them. We have now entered into a long-term agreement with the City of Bovee, and we can guarantee that these sort of situations won't arise for the City of Bovee again. The basic fundamentals of accounting will be done for them. They don't have to worry about that anymore. Including the LGA payment for Bovee will do something very important to our region. It's going to incentivize these smaller communities to begin working together. We're already beginning to see that in the contract with Bovee and Grand Rapids, with Big Fork and Cohasset. And we're also seeing a potential of a regional approach to local government up there, to where the individual cities keep their own identities, but the basic fundamentals of accounting and other back office services can be done in collaboration. And we think that's an important step, and we'll literally save hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes over the next 5 to 10 years for the cities in the Grand Rapids area. For the sake of brevity, I'll stop there.
Thank you. And we have Senator Dames, Vesta.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Today I have with me Gene
Gladys. Jean is the city clerk of Vesta, and Jean would just like to take a few minutes and go over a prepared statement explaining what happened in Vesta and why it's the deadline.
Thank you, Madam. Jean Gladys, and I am city clerk of the city of Vesta, which is a small town in the Redwood County, consisting of 319 people. I'd like to thank you for hearing my testimony this morning. The situation in Vesta that led us to this position has an extensive history. The year 2010 started with significant turnover of council and city employees. The mayor of 2010 resigned at the beginning of the year, and a council member took over and completed that term. A new mayor took office in 2011 and served 1 year before resigning due to serious health issues. At that time, current Mayor Ellie Bonney took over the position. Through these turnovers in mayor, there were also significant turnovers in council. Along with council turnover between the years of 2010 and 2012, the city hired a new city clerk, two liquor store managers, and a new city auditor, which is outside of the, which is an outside city CPA firm. If you refer to the City of Vesta 2010 audit timeline that you've been given, you can see specific events during the auditing process that has led us to this position. We would like to draw your attention to a few of the specific events. The first is June 7th, 2011. At this time, the city auditor notified the council that due to liquor store discrepancies and grants received, the audit could not be completed by the June 30th, 2011 deadline. The auditor then filed for an extension. The next event we would like to reference is June 10th, 2011, when the city auditor, an outside CPA firm, contacted the state auditor and received a verbal extension, but not specific date was mentioned as a new deadline, and the city did not receive confirmation of this extension. Again, on August 15th, the city auditor was in contact with the state auditor, and there was no mention of the September 30th deadline. The city did receive letters on August 25th and September 15th from the office of the state auditor stating the September 30th deadline. The city of Vesta made an incorrect assumption that the city auditor, the outside CPA firm, was given this same information through their conversations with the state auditor's office, and we failed to forward them our correspondence. The final events we would like to address began on September 27th when the city of Vesta approved the 2010 audit, when the city auditor, the outside firm, attempted to assess the submission site on September 28th. The passwords failed for reasons unknown. With a weekend in the mix and process of recreating passwords and communicating them from the city to the city auditor, pushed our audit submission past the deadline. After receiving the penalty of loss of LGA, the city has taken corrective action to be sure we maintain proper communication. From this point on, all correspondence received by the clerk from any governing agency will be date stamped and forwarded to council, mayor, lawyer, and city attorney or city auditor, no matter how insignificant the information may seem. From here, we would like to outline why the loss of LGA is a negative impact on our city. We have a water project. Our city is currently working through a three-phase water project due to recommendations from
Ms. Gladys. Forgive me for interrupting.
Yep.
But I think you members here would understand why this would be a very big impact on your city. And in the interest of being able to act on your bills today, I would ask you to end there so that we could hear briefly from Big Fork. And I want to point out for members a letter from the Office of the State Auditor that's in your packet if you haven't seen it. We asked the question, how many cities end up unable to or don't comply with the auditing requirements, and how many have impacts to their LGA for their inability to get those accounts done. 2011, there were 18 cities. I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, all of you, that all three of you have subsequently filed your required reports. You're all in good standing now with the city, with the auditor, and so what we're asking now is whether or not we should continue to withhold the LGA payments from these cities now that they've complied. And members, I would also point out that there is a revenue note in each one
And it looks to me we can have folks from the department testify here, but the revenue note indicates the amount of the LGA that's withheld would be the fiscal impact of granting them this relief, which is a struggle for me to wrap my head around, but we're going to talk with the Department of Revenue about how they came up with that note. But if we could hear from Big Fork.
Madam Chair.
Senator Saxhoff.
Yes, I'm going to introduce a Big Fork Council Member, Bob Zimmer, who's going to give a few words on what happened 40 miles north of Grand Rapids.
Thank you. Mr. Zimmer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We had a city clerk who had the inability to file information with the auditors on a timely manner, and therefore our paperwork was delayed. He has since resigned. The following day we got our notification we were not going to get LGA funding. The following day we got a notice from our CPA firm they would no longer represent us. We now have a new city clerk. We've contracted with the city of Cohasset to come in and get us back on board. We found a new auditor. They will give us a full report by the end of March on our current status. It is very important to the citizens of Big Fork that we receive our $84,000. We certainly like to be reconsidered for that. It is 38% of our budget.
Thank you. Senator Saxhog and Senator Dames and members of the committee, questions or comments before we have the Department of Revenue and the State Auditor come up and advise us a little?
Madam okay. Chair, I just reiterate a little bit of what Administrator Gillen said, is that regional government for these types of services I think has a lot of real potential, and that's what we're working on up in our area. And so I think the whole idea of that happening could be helpful in the future.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I've got a question. Did for either the senators, did you at all get a notification from the auditor's office? And because I believe I had a city that didn't file their financial report, and they were not going to get their LGA, and I received a report of that, and I'm just wondering, is that a report that goes out to legislators? Because then I personally got involved and contacted the city and said, you know, if you don't get this completed in time, you're not going to be eligible for your LGA, and then they got it completed in time. So I'm just wondering, was there a notification process?
Senator Saxhoff.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, yes, we do get a notification of that, and we pass that on to the cities affected.
So, Madam Chair?
Senator Howe.
I can't speak for Senator Dames.
Senator Dames.
Sure
Madam Chair, I did not receive a notification of this, so I did not receive one.
All right, can we have Mr. Ouellette join us, and Ms. McQuay and Mr. Paulson? I understand you're also available to advise us. The state auditor couldn't be here today, so we do have the letter in the packet. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make that comment because when I reached out to him, I said, you know, my office was willing to help them and get involved, but if they didn't take action, there wasn't much I expected to do, to come and ask for a grace period or an extension. And I'm just wondering if there's a list. Have we done this in the past? And if we haven't done it in the past, is it just a one-time thing? So the next time it happens, they don't try and come in again and ask for forgiveness on it. So I guess I need to get some history on it.
Well, Senator Howe, these bills are specific to the 2011 LGA payment. Is that correct? They're not asking for future special treatment. They have subsequently filed their accounting, and so they're asking us to provide relief on their 2011 LGA payment. Now, I don't know, and I'm hoping Mr. Ouellette will let me know about the rest of these cities and what the status is for the remaining 15 cities, if you know. Mr. Ouellette.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Eric Ouellette with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I think Jason Nord is in a better position to talk about the status of the individual cities. I can talk to you about how we came up with the revenue estimate that we did. So I don't know which question you want us to tackle first.
Well, since you're testifying now, the revenue estimate is the amount of the LGA that is currently being withheld. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, The way we do revenue estimates is we look at a we look at a piece of legislation and we ask, does it change how much the general fund will receive or pay compared to current law? Under current law, according to the state auditor, this money will cancel to the general fund at the end of the fiscal year. So if you do not act on these bills, there's going to be a savings to the state general fund in the amount of these withholdings. By passing this legislation, the state will pay out those amounts of LGA to these cities, and that means that that will be a cost to the general fund.
I mean, you've kind of said it both ways now, Mr. Ouellette. So which one is it? Are you assuming that this money is not going to get paid and then we'll have a hole in the general fund? Or are you assuming that it will get paid and we're even? Which one is it?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. We are assuming that without this legislation, this LGA will not get paid. The state auditor in the past has withheld aid, and it cancels back to the general fund. The amount that had been certified in LGA then never gets paid out. So then at the end of the fiscal year, that money reverts to the general fund and increases the balance in the general fund. There have been many cities over the past many years for whom they do never get the LGA payment and they lose the money. So that's what these revenue estimates reflect.
However, we haven't reached the end of the fiscal year yet. So there's if we pass this legislation, there's really no impact yet. There would be no impact to the general fund. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, the information that I received from the state auditor's office is that without this legislation, the LGA will not be paid. With this legislation, the LGA will be paid. This legislation, therefore, causes the state to pay more in LGA than it would if this legislation doesn't pass. We had conversations with the fiscal staff.
I think you should stop there. I think the other members and I are a little surprised that you're already counting on the savings from non-compliance on the part of our cities that are being required to provide audit information. Am I wrong about that? The sense of the committee is that's pretty frustrating. Senator Bach.
Well, Madam Chair, I think my guess is the committee's assumption is this money was going to be paid out.
Right.
And that tax bill was signed into law last year. So it's hardly new spend. It'd be hard to score as a new spend.
I couldn't agree more, Senator Bach. Right. We all intended when we made our budget, adopted the budget, it was that money would go to Vesta, Big Fork, and Bovee. And they weren't able to get their accounting done, but they've since done it. And I think the assumption should still be that we're going to pay them their LGA. Now, the rest of the cities, I'm not so sure about. But I think Ms. McQuay may be able to add something to this conversation. Ms. McQuay.
Madam Chair and members, the only thing that I would add is even though the February forecast and this committee's budget forecasted the full amount of LGA, there is also a line item in the general fund budget allowing for or anticipating $20 million in cancellations. And so this is where this cancellation would be forecasted. So technically, the line item for these cities that don't turn in their audits is not forecasted. There is a broad general fund cancellation line item in the forecast.
Okay, and that includes lots of things other than just LGA, right?
Madam Chair, it's the entire general fund budget.
All right, that helps tremendously. Okay, Mr. Ouellette,
Madam Chair, can I add one more thing?
Of course, yes.
We do recognize that this is an unusual revenue estimate. We spent extensive time the last few days talking with fiscal staff from the House, the Senate, and the MMB about what the appropriate way to handle this bill was. I understand why it's confusing, but this was the answer that we did get in discussions with MMB and House and Senate fiscal staff.
Well, I hope that you'll message back our skepticism about the way these were prepared, because
I think there
was more here that should have been explained. I think the cancellation fund makes a lot of sense. Senator Howell?
Madam Chair, could you tell us how many of the 18 have since filed their reports?
That was my next question, or my previous question. Mr. Nord, welcome to the committee.
Here, Jason Nord, State Program Director with the Department of Revenue. All I know is from a letter that the state auditor has sent to, I believe, the House and Senate Tax Committee, they indicate that there are still six cities that haven't completed out of the 18, there are still six that haven't completed their financial reporting, but we haven't received any indication directly from the state auditor.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
So we're dealing with three here, is that correct? But there's been 12, so there's nine other cities that qualify for some form of LGA that either haven't contacted a representative or feel there's maybe no appeal process. And I guess my concern is should we be treating cities that either get someone to come and advocate for their position differently than other cities that have fulfilled their obligation has since made good? I mean, are we going to treat them all the same, or are we just going to give somebody who has somebody's ear a better deal? That's my question.
Well, Senator Howe, I have the same concern, and I guess I would ask the Department of Revenue to consult with the state auditor and give us a list of the 18 and their current status. If they have subsequently complied, I'd like to know the date of their compliance, and then we can talk with legislators and see if they might want to offer some kind of amendment. I think the date of compliance is significant here.
Sure.
And we can probably get a little information from the office of the state auditor to give us more information. But I wouldn't want to hold up these three who have come to us to ask for relief and for the LGA that we wanted them to have. And so I would like to move forward with these three, and then hopefully the committee will assist if we decide to offer amendments on the Senate floor to provide the same kind of relief to the other cities that have complied. If they haven't yet complied, I think that's maybe, for me, a barrier. Senator Rust.
Madam Chair, and so the ultimate goal might be a more general application rather than city by city. Is that
right,
might
exactly.
be your intent?
If they've subsequently complied, I think we should consider
listing the criteria and then say the money can go.
Right, but I also think then it is incumbent upon the members of this committee and the representatives of those being affected to look at this penalty. Because the penalty seems to be extreme. If you're going to take all of their LGA for not providing the accounting, maybe it should be a 10%, or maybe it should be a gradual penalty that instead of it's all or nothing, you get your reporting done. And
but it's got to be big enough so that it's a stick.
Well, and it could be maybe 5% in the first week and 10% in the first month and 50% by 60 days. But I don't think all or nothing is a very workable plan here. Mr. Paulson.
Madam Chair, on the second page of the letter from the state auditor, there is a list of those 17 cities. So that we have that available now.
Right, but I'd like to know whether they're in compliance and their date of compliance, Mr. Paulson. I'm hoping that the Department of Revenue, working with the Office of the Auditor, can help us get that information right away as we prepare this omnibus bill. We might be able to offer that amendment when we roll that bill out. And I would entertain that. I think it would be good to do. And if any of the members here would like to work on a more graduated penalty system for this, I would welcome your efforts on that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, I do appreciate your willingness to look at this penalty, because I don't know about all these towns, but the ones I do know are very small, 300 some odd people. They live month to month, week to week, and that would be a huge deal for them. So the resources are limited sometimes and strained.
Well, I will ask counsel, Mr. Sylvia, to draft a more graduated penalty for us to consider when we roll out the omnibus bill. And maybe it is 5% for the first week, it's 10% for the first month, and then 50% at 60 days, and then maybe 100 at 120, something like that. But it should complement what the state auditor currently is doing in terms of the deadlines, the numbers of dates, because there's an extension period here, I think. And so we want to see if we can't work with the Department of Revenue and the state auditor on that, Mr. Sylvia, if you would.
Okay.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Paulson.
Just one other thing. There is a House file introduced this year, House File 2786, that does release all cities from the penalty for 2011, and the revenue estimate on that is $795,000. So.
Well, as I said before, the all cities isn't that attractive to me, because I want them to have the incentive to file the audit reports, and the revenue estimate isn't affecting me one way or another. It just doesn't. But I appreciate the information so much, Mr. Paulson. Other questions or comments on this issue? Mr. Nord.
Madam Chair, and I, just as you're looking at a timing issue as far as how many days late they were, some of these reports are due March 31st. Some, I believe, are due in June. And so by the time they're losing their December LGA payment, they're already at least 6 months late. So as you work on some kind of timing, you may want to take those dates into account.
Well, your recommendation and your efforts, Mr. Nord, would be appreciated by Mr. Sylvia, I'm sure, and we can work together on this to I think we should have a more graduated penalty system. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I think your idea is a great idea to have some sort of a sliding scale. I would like to ask a question, Madam Chair, about the notification process. You know, are legislators notified when cities in their districts aren't in compliance?
Well, and Senator Howe, maybe you'd like to work on that. I don't know.
Well, I was just going to ask from the
department. How
do you
feel about that? But Mr. Nord.
Madam Chair, or Senator Howe, the department just receives the notification from the state auditor's office and as to whether or not we should execute a payment or not. So we're not really involved in the state auditor's notification to the cities or to the or to senators and representatives. So I don't know the answer to that.
But Madam Chair,
Senator Rest.
To Senator Howe's point, it is public knowledge. I mean, and I would assume that the cities themselves are going to find a way to spread the word that they didn't get their LGA. So I'm not sure that directing them to contact each individual legislator is necessary once information is published. And maybe that could be the requirement rather than having to contact making sure the public knows as opposed to contacting individual legislators.
Well, I think, Senator Est, if you're talking about illness of a key employee, even the members of the city council might have no idea what's happening. I mean, that's what I'm concerned about are these cities that have, you know, one or two employees, and they're just losing track of what's happening here. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I'm not saying that's a good idea or a bad idea. I'm just asking, why was I notified? I mean, what is the notification process? What's the rationale? And it seems like Senator Dames wasn't notified. Senator Saxhoggs was notified. I was notified. And I'm just wondering what that reporting process is.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Howe, a number of times over the years of my service here, I've been notified of cities that haven't been in compliance. And I think it's the state auditor that's sending that notice out.
Thank you. Senator Bach.
You know, we get, but does anybody know why? I think we do get a notification if our volunteer firefighter relief association pension obligations aren't, if the reporting requirements aren't met. Because I've received it. Mm-hmm. So it's not unique, I guess.
Strange.
Right, yeah. Hardly any consistency there, but I think that's part of the problem here. But nonetheless, without further objection, I'd like to lay over for possible inclusion Senate File 1840 for VESTA, Senate File 1481 for Bovee, Senate File 1583 for Big Fork, and we will continue to work, members, on if we can provide relief to additional cities that have complied and work on a more gradual penalty provision for our omnibus bill. Without objection, they will be held over. Members, we have no further business today,
but I'll remind you, Madam Chair, members, that
you're so welcome. We have committee tomorrow from 8:30 to 11. Can we do yours tomorrow? Senator Bach, is that all right? I'm sorry. Thank you.